KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
Welcome to the Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature and the human heart.
It's all alive. It's all connected. It's all intelligent. It's all relatives.
And so instead, what we need is ocean farms and other things that are akin, breathing life back into these ecosystems. So as ocean farmers, we're actually helping the ecosystem heal and rebuild. And I think the marine park of the future looks like, take 2,000 acres, right? And you've got farmers farming on part of it. They're doing reforestation on another part, just planting kelp and shellfish, right? With the same skills they have, but not harvesting it. Then you've got artisanal fisheries and like ecotourism, and that's a marine park of the future.
In this first of a two-part program, we take a deep dive into a breakthrough so transformative that it could remake agriculture from the bottom up, the bottom of the ocean, while regenerating oceans, farmlands, farmer livelihoods, and the climate. This is Blue Revolution, Regenerative Ocean Farming with Bren Smith and his Solve the Whole Problem recipe book. I'm Neil Harvey. Welcome to The Bioneers, revolution from the heart of nature. As climate disruption bears down, our food system is one of our greatest vulnerabilities. Land-based agriculture in its current form will not survive global weirding, bedeviled by extreme heat, droughts, floods, freshwater scarcity, and overall erratic weather patterns that are all over the map, literally. And in many cases, it's conventional agriculture itself that's worsening the very conditions that will topple it. Something's got to give, starting with the underlying paradigm. In an iconic 1981 essay, the esteemed writer and farmer Wendell Berry wrote that the key to overcoming our escalating agricultural crisis is what he called solving for pattern. It's a solution that addresses multiple problems at once in a self-reinforcing way by addressing the larger pattern of the entire system. It's a solve-the-whole-problem approach. What makes Bren Smith's regenerative ocean farming model innovative is that it solves for pattern. At the same time that land-based farming faces extreme systemic threats, if the fishing business continues as usual, many ocean fisheries are projected to collapse by 2050. Regenerative ocean farming offers a breakthrough pathway for addressing these twin crises. This type of marine-based farming, known as mariculture, is an extraordinarily productive and low-impact way of producing vast quantities of food for a growing population. Simultaneously, this regeneration revolution aims to redesign the food economy away from destructive profit-driven practices and agribusiness monopolies in favor of democratizing the food economy. And that's just the foam on an ocean of possibilities. Bren Smith is the co-executive director and co-founder of Green Wave, a nonprofit that trains and supports regenerative ocean farmers. We spoke with him in an online conversation.
Our land-based food system is being pushed out to sea, right? Whether it's droughts, wildfires, the lack of nutrients in the soil. Like, we're going to have to get more food from the ocean. I think there's no question about that. But our oceans, wild populations can't bear the brunt of that. 90% of fish stocks are either overfished or fished at their limits. Like, we need to actually roll back the impact of industrial fishing.
A fisherman is all Bren Smith ever wanted to be. Born in Newfoundland, Canada, he headed out to sea when he was 14 after dropping out of school. He fished in Gloucester and Lynn for tuna and lobster, and later shipped out to the Bering Sea for many years. Then the cod stocks crashed. It triggered the biggest layoff in Canadian history, with 35,000 people thrown out of work. Bren watched fishermen wandering the streets like displaced persons, boats beached, canneries dead empty. He saw that industrial fishing operated by essentially clear-cutting entire underwater ecosystems while chasing fewer and fewer fish further and further out to sea. He knew there would be no jobs on a dead planet. That blood-chilling experience jolted his relationship with the sea. He looked to conventional aquaculture, but realized it was the wretched analog of putting Iowa pig farms on the sea.
I mean, I was so excited to go farm fish, right? Because I was told this was the future, we were going to feed the planet, and it was just like this hotbed of learning. But then I got out to the farms, and it was really, really heartbreaking, you know, using pesticides, antibiotics, fish breaks. The fish tasted terrible. They looked terrible. I think the aquaculture industry at that time, although it's really tried to make improvements, there are a lot of good folks really trying to innovate, but it chose the wrong thing. Like, aquaculture did not ask the ocean, what does it make sense to grow? What it did was it asked the market, right? And what the market said at the time was, like, everybody likes to eat salmon and tuna. Why don't you grow salmon and tuna? And what we need to do is flip that and ask the ocean, what does it make sense to grow? What's unique about the ocean as an agricultural space? And you ask that, and the ocean says, why don't you grow things that you don't have to feed and don't swim away? And I think that was then my journey. Let's grow as many of those species as possible. And that's how you get to regenerative ocean farming at the end of the day.
Synchronicity struck. When New York's Long Island Sound reopened to oyster farmers in order to attract young people into the shellfishing industry, Bren started Thimble Island Ocean Farm to grow oysters off the coast of Connecticut. Again, he encountered new secondary problems and had to change course.
God, was I a bad oyster farmer. Like, really bad at it. I killed millions of oysters my first couple years because it was psychologically such a different thing. Like, you know, I'm a hunter-gatherer in my nature. And suddenly I was floating around in the same 20 acres, you know, supposedly cultivating these little creatures. And I found it boring at first. I was like, where are the rogue waves? Where's the excitement? But eventually I just fell in love, like developing the blue thumb, just really watching the winds and waves on this small patch of water and just knowing every inch of it every season. There's a real thrill to that. You know, I'd been oyster farming for about 7 years, was very successful because I was close to New York. It was sort of the emergence of the boutique Brooklyn oyster scene, right? And that's where I really learned to think and appreciate food, because I'm both not an environmentalist, but I'm not a foodie either. You know, I like to eat at the gas station is my favorite. So that, you know, the oyster company was doing real well. And then Hurricane Irene and Sandy came in, and that was hurricanes destroying my farm 2 years in a row. And 1 year is one thing, right? You're like, oh, terrible, but let me pick myself up, start again. You get hit 2 years in a row with 90% of your crop gone, over half your gear destroyed, and you realize that this is the new normal. Climate change at that point was supposed to be a slow lobster boil. It was going to be a 100-year-off problem. And the environmentalists and public policy people were talking about it, like, let's protect and save our children. And suddenly I was in the canary in the coal mine. I was like, no, this is about my farm, my boat, my livelihood, and it's right now. It was depressing, I got to be honest. That moment, I think, was the best moment of my life, where out of the negativity and the hopelessness sort of bred, I think, opportunity. You know, our backs are against the wall. Very often humans do their best thing. So that's where I started.
Meanwhile, climate chaos was becoming a faster lobster boil. What to do? The swelling human population is projected to need 56% more food to feed nearly 10 billion people by 2050. And just 7% of existing fisheries can handle any more fishing at all. His back to the wall, Bren Smith landed an epiphany.
What I did was, okay, the storm surge comes in, buries all my crop. Let's move off the seafloor and use that entire water column. And let's grow as many of these species that are similar to oysters as possible. And we have all these species. There are hundreds of kind of shellfish, 10,000 different seaweeds that's possible to grow. I mean, imagine being a chef and finding there are arugulas, tomatoes, kales that you've never seen, tasted, or cooked with before. Suddenly what becomes this very depressing story becomes a story of like an entirely new climate cuisine. which taps into the creativity, I think, of one of the great culinary moments in American history, I mean, which is right now. The other thing is, like, you know, who's going to eat seaweed, right? And that's one of the core questions. Shellfish is much easier. All the our collaborative chefs that are making it, you know, things delicious, like barbecue kelp noodles with parsnips and breadcrumbs, like this delicious way to make a vegetable a little unhealthy and also really, like, unravel our associations with seaweed. It's just a delicious dish. You know, as I've dove into this, what we found is that, yes, we can do this as food, but tastes change slowly. What's powerful about kelp is that it can be used in so many different ways. Right now, we've got a whole leaf strategy. And just from my farm last harvest season, the stems we turned into kelp pickles. The next set of the stem we turned into kelp flour and used it in plant-based burgers as well, right? So that's the ingredient. Then we don't have any waste because we're planning ahead.
Beneath the surface, regenerative ocean farming is a real-life octopus's garden. At an event hosted by ABC Home in New York, biologist and author Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson interviewed Bren Smith and asked him to describe what a 20-acre farm looks like.
Imagine an underwater garden, right? And you've got hurricane-proof anchors on the edges, then you've got horizontal ropes connecting these anchor systems. It's just a rope scaffolding system underwater. And from there, we grow our kelp vertically downwards, mussels, our scallops in lantern nets, and then cages down in the bottom and clams in the mud. And the idea is just to figure out how many different species we can grow in 20 acres. This is really permaculture of the ocean.
The mussels grow in a sock. Could you just, like, explain a mussel sock for those who may not be familiar?
Sure. So when we seed the kelp, and after we harvest it, there are the little stipes left over on the rope, right? And mussels love those little stipes that are left over. And
stipes are seaweed stems.
Yes, seaweed stems, exactly. And so the mussels stick to all those stems and grow out, and we then rip the mussels off, and we put them in these socks, sort of like make sausages out of them. And so, and then we hang them back on the kelp line. And the idea is we can use the same gear, we can rotate crops, keep growing year-round.
So you've got, like, stuff in the mud, you've got stuff on the mud, you've got three different things hanging and growing, and then you have different things that you're growing in different seasons. So it's a year-round scenario. How many tons comes out of one of these small farms?
It's about 10 to 20 tons of seaweed per acre and about 250,000 shellfish per acre.
Bren Smith shows how we can sustainably harvest massive quantities of protein and nutritious vegetables from the seas in ways that also restore coastlines, communities, local economies, and the climate. When we return, Bren rocks the boat by demonstrating regenerative ocean farming's mighty potential to sequester carbon and restore ocean ecosystems. This is Blue Revolution, Regenerative Ocean Farming. You're listening to The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Have you ever attended the annual Bioneers Conference? This year, we're taking the conference online so you can take part wherever you are. November 11th through 13th, the conference features best-selling author and forest ecologist Suzanne Simard, co-author of Inflamed, Dr. Rupa Maria, and many more. Visit bioneers.org/listener or call 1-877-BIONEER.
Regenerative ocean farming is a textbook model of solving for pattern. It flips the extractive paradigm into a paradigm of regeneration, from vicious cycle to virtuous cycle. One of the biggest challenges farmers have faced for decades in scaling up organic farming is getting enough organic fertilizer and compost. The supply just isn't there. Bringing that fertilizer from the ocean to the land can help meet the needs of farmers in an ecologically beneficial way. Kelp provides rich fertilizer for soils and healthy feed for animals. Feeding kelp to cows and sheep is not only very good for the animals' health, it reduces their climate-crashing burps of methane emissions by a jaw-dropping 80 to 90%.
I was at the Al Gore's Climate Underground, all about regenerative farming. I was the only ocean person there out of like 200-300 people. And everybody was complaining and like up in arms about the nutrient crisis, right? Like our soils are dead and we really need more nutrients. And I was like, I got them all, right? It's they're in the oceans, that nitrogen, the phosphorus, all the micronutrients. So let's use our things like kelp to soak those up and bring them back to the soil, right? Create a virtuous nutrient loop. Let's build a bridge between land and sea. There is a long history of using seaweeds as fertilizer and feed. In fact, in the banks, on the docks of San Diego, in the early 1900s, there were 1,500 workers producing fertilizer and feed out of kelp. That was wild kelp at that point, for up to 1,000 land-based farms in the Midwest. I say this is something we've done. It's just that, you know, corporate industrial ag, you know, with fertilizer, with soy, things like that have just pushed it off the table in terms of one of the tools that are out there for farmers to farm regeneratively. So I think there's a huge potential there.
Kelp can also be made into compostable plastics and biofuels. An area the size of the state of Maine could replace all the oil in the U.S., according to the U.S. Department of Energy. As climate chaos continues stressing terrestrial farming, regenerative ocean farming can mitigate and start reversing some of the most catastrophic effects. Here's Brent Smith again with biologist Ayana Johnson.
Our farm, for example, soaks up nitrogen. The seaweeds soak up carbon. Kelp is called the sequoia of the sea. It soaks up 5 times more carbon than land-based plants. One journalist called it the culinary equivalent of the electric car, which is a beautiful phrase. The farms function as storm surge protectors and artificial reefs to just attract all these species that come hide and thrive. I mean, my area, when I first came into farm, it was a barren patch of ocean, and now it's a thriving ecosystem.
So how big a deal is the fact that as the kelp grows, it's absorbing tons of CO2? Like, obviously, we need to be drawing down carbon and absorbing it and sequestering it. And photosynthesis is like the most underrated climate solution, in my opinion. So shout out to photosynthesis. How big an impact does it make? Like, sure, it absorbs CO2 like all plants do, but at what scale does that help?
Yeah.
Because we've got a pretty big climate crisis on our hands.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the World Bank did a study, and they said if you take less than 5% of U.S. Waters, you could sequester the amount of carbon put out by, I think it was 120 million cars, create 50 million jobs, and the protein equivalent of 3 trillion cheeseburgers, right? So this is scalable.
All of these benefits make Bren Smith hopeful that regenerative ocean farming can be implemented on serious scales to address climate disruption and ecological degradation in self-reinforcing cycles of mutual benefits.
Kelp is the rainforest of the sea. And the oceans have always played this central regulatory role on the planet, right? I think they've soaked up 90% of the excess heat, and 30% of the carbon put out by humans has been sequestered by the ocean. And kelp is one of the sort of, you know, heroic plants in that process. We think of it as blue carbon. It just makes it really powerful. So the kelp sequesters carbon. The oysters and shellfish play this really important role in the nitrogen cycle. So an oyster filters up to 50 gallons of water a day, and they feed on nitrogen. That's what they do. That's incredible because this sort of Mother Nature's technology is filtering that nitrogen out of the water column. And land-based farming, as well as other things, is creating over-nitrification in our oceans. And if you get too much nitrification in the ocean, you get dead zones. So there are these massive zones all over the globe where nothing is alive. There's not enough oxygen. Everything's been killed off. Oysters are really the sort of the warriors against that. There was a study on the Pacific Northwest that surrounded an oyster farm with kelp, and they found something called the halo effect. Inside that kelp halo, the acidification rates were much lower than outside. Right? These are just powerful technologies that Mother Nature has given us.
A groundbreaking study by the Nature Conservancy and the University of New England has provided strong evidence that shellfish and seaweed farming are a critical component of regenerative food production. And the kelp grows fast, as much as a foot per day. Its structure fosters a sanctuary for biodiverse marine life without excluding human interaction.
Mother Nature hates monoculture. Right? You grow a single species in density. You know, if you had a kelp farm that was 1,000 acres, Mother Nature would attack it, right? If you just grow salmon, Mother Nature attacks it all the time. What we want to do is mimic and grow all these species together and do what she does well, right? And the benefit of that is that all the species are working together on the farm, and it creates an entire reef for other creatures, right? So it's a foundational system to rebuild reefs, the farms are. That's sort of a whole package of benefits that the farming model brings. The other thing is, like, we seed the farms, and then all our crops send more seed into the natural environment. We only use native species. And so, yes, we're farming and harvesting, but we're overproducing. And so rebuilding that ecosystem all around us, I think that's what one of my frustrations, honestly, with part of the environmental movement is that it's obsessed with conservation, right? So we need to set things aside. So, like, for example, take the ocean and create marine parks. But I think what they don't understand is in the era, or maybe they understand but aren't sort of really grappled with, is we could set aside the entire ocean as a marine park and it'll die because of climate change. And so instead what we need is ocean farms and other things that are akin, breathing life back into these ecosystems. So as ocean farmers, we're actually helping the ecosystem heal and rebuild. And I think the marine park of the future looks like, take 2,000 acres, right? And you've got farmers farming on part of it. They're doing reforestation on another part, just planting kelp and shellfish, right, with the same skills they have, but not harvesting it. Then you've got artisanal fisheries and, like, ecotourism. And that's what a marine park of the future, as opposed to this place where you're never allowed to go and we just slowly let die.
By mimicking nature's playbook, we can help nature heal itself and set in motion a virtuous cycle of regeneration. In this paradigm, human beings are no longer the bad guys. In truth, indigenous peoples have long held this kind of knowledge. When the Europeans first set foot on North America, what the first peoples called Turtle Island, they saw a vast, undisturbed wilderness of endless bounty. In reality, there were about 100 million Native Americans living there in a vast, thriving landscape they actively cultivated with extraordinary sophistication, including farming ocean oyster and clam beds. The coastal Miwok in what's now San Francisco's Bay Area maintained clam beds for centuries. Then the Forest Service declared the area a preserve and told the Miwok people they couldn't harvest clams anymore. The Miwoks asked, "Don't you understand? The clams know we're coming. If we don't come, they'll die." The Forest Service summarily dismissed their plea. Then the overpopulated, untended clam bed began to fail and died. What the Miwok had been consciously doing was the equivalent of weeding a garden. They had sustained the beds year after year for centuries. GreenWave's regenerative ocean farming model further serves to detoxify waters. Since so-called waste doesn't exist in nature, it becomes a game of mixing and matching organisms to create desirable food webs. It's a process to clean water and soil that's called bioremediation. As a powerful bioaccumulator, seaweed absorbs pollutants as well as excess nutrients. For decades, the mining industry has used bioaccumulator plants to remove heavy metals from sites poisoned by surface mining. It's then possible to reclaim and recycle the metals from the plants.
So we really see our farming working in multiple ways. We have farming for food, and the key is shellfish are the most traceable regulated food in the country because it's a live product. So we've incorporated our seaweed into that regulatory regime. Like, you wish your arugula was as traceable as our seaweeds and shellfish. So regulation traceability has been key on that. We also grow in polluted waters on purpose just to soak up heavy metals, to rebuild those reefs. So we had a farm along with Dr. Charlie Yarish in the Branch River, for example. And that was just to do ecosystem services, right, to rebuild that. We've got another farm we're working with the Port of San Diego in California. And then the other thing is, like, we can just, the same skills for farming are required for food as they are with reforestation. So because we can use our seaweeds to draw down that carbon, even say someday we can't eat it, it still has a role. Like, we need to create the hatcheries and the skills to get people out there replanting the world's rainforest underwater, essentially. As public policy moves forward, if it moves the wrong way, maybe someday I'll just be the Johnny Appleseed of camp out there all day. And that's fine. I still get to die in my boat, right? And that's the goal. But hopefully society will get its act together before that.
After decades of destructive farming practices and inaction on changing misbegotten policies and practices, global weirding is escalating the stakes. Massive change and mounting ecological disruption are inevitable. It's not a question not of if everything's going to change, but how. And this time, says Bren Smith, it's all power to the imagination and all hands on deck.
I feel desperate at a personal level, and I think a lot of folks I knew, that we need a new story to tell ourselves, right, for this new era. So we're saying goodbye to one world, and we're just in a period where we're being introduced to a whole new one. There's opportunity out in the ocean in a major way. 40% of our country lives on the in coastal communities. Like, head out to sea and get to work. And that doesn't mean, you know, like I do, farming in the winter and breaking ice off the gunwale. Go into public policy and help us shape really progressive, powerful legislation that protects communities, right? Go build a hatchery in your basement to create a community garden locally, right, where you're welcoming folks out to grow their own food. Start clam gardens so community members can come down, harvest the clams, and feed themselves, right? Be a place for food security. There are a lot of ways to engage, and certainly there are just so many open questions and challenges that we face in this industry that we need all sorts of creative thinking.
Bren Smith is writing Historic Tides of Change. In part two of this program, we explore the once-in-a-civilization opportunity to use regenerative ocean farming to remake the food economy from the bottom up, the bottom of the ocean. Blue Revolution, Regenerative Ocean Farming. You can explore more of our media at bioneers.org. Subscribe to our podcast and newsletters and find out how to follow us on social media. This program is a production of the Collective Heritage Institute. Executive producer, Kenny Ossibel. Written by Kenny Ossibel. Senior producer and station relations, Stephanie Welch. Host and consulting producer, Neil Harvey. Producer, Teo Grossman. Program engineer and music supervisor, Emily Harris. Production intern, Isabel Dean. My name is Neil Harvey. Thank you for listening. This is program number 244.
This program was made possible in part by Guayaki Yerba Mate, working with indigenous farmers in South America to grow shade-grown organic yerba mate to inspire us all to come to life. Learn more about Guayaki's products and regenerative mission at guayaki.com.
Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the program.
In 1944, my grandmother, known to me as Omi, was 1 year old, living with her mother, brother, and sister in a village near the German city of Königsberg on the Baltic Sea. In the summer of that year, the family packed their belongings, a sewing machine, coffee grinder, woolen balaclavas and mitts. The furniture was covered, fruits and vegetables preserved in jars and stacked on the shelves, because they thought they were coming back. The children were baptized. They boarded a train in the city's central station and headed west. That winter, the Red Army arrived in Königsberg and murdered 300,000 civilians. Many walked across the frozen Baltic to escape the massacre, but they made easy targets for the Russian bombers against the pale ice that shattered beneath their feet. When Germany was divided, the family found themselves in the East, where life was hard. Omi's mother grew tobacco, dried it, and sold her cigarettes in American boxes to buy food. Sending the children ahead, she smuggled herself to the border, posed as a railway worker, shunted carriages and followed the tracks west, wearing a boiler suit and her black leather riding boots. The family reunited in Hamburg and moved into a bombed-out basement with Uncle Walter, who built a home from styrofoam and corrugated metal with a wash basin and plates, towels, cups, a small table. The sewing machine and coffee grinder arrived in 1954. It's 2019 and Omi lives in a terraced house at the edge of a forest in northern Germany. She spends the winter gathering mushrooms, and in the summer she takes her old Volkswagen camper van touring around the Baltic Sea. She sends me photographs of the seaside and flowers in the dunes. This year Omi wants to drive to the town where she was born, now in the Russian enclave of Kaliningrad. It has been 75 years, and she asks if I will come with her. It can be a holiday of sorts, the two of us and the van. We haven't travelled together since I was a child, but this is a journey she doesn't want to take alone. Summer is waning, but the sea is warm. Omi launches herself into the shallows of the Baltic. Dry grasses prick our legs as we gather field mushrooms and apples from a tree tucked in the dunes. Back at the van, Omi cleans the windscreen, sweeps the floor and makes up the camp bed where the two of us have been sleeping head to toe for the past week, as we travel through pine forest and marram grasses, buying smoked fish at the side of the road. It is mid-morning when Omi weaves through concrete barriers at the checkpoint between Lithuania and Russian Kaliningrad, a narrow spit of land in the grey sea. She yanks the handbrake and a soldier escorts us to a hut, checks our papers and searches the van, scans its underside with mirrors. The road is potholed on the other side of the border. Omi is shaken by the crossing, swerves at speed and pulls into a lay-by, handbrake on. The pine forest is a tangle of cobwebs, scattered with a thick stratum of needles. No mushrooms here. We head back to the road. In the afternoon, military helicopters fly low against the sun as the landscape opens to farmland, both of us staring ahead at asphalt as the old van ticks along. That evening, Omi pulls onto a gravel track. We wander amongst the mosses and reindeer lichen, gathering handfuls of blueberries, hunting for gold streaks of chanterelles. The tension of this morning is lost to the cool air of the forest. She has a foraging eye, combs amongst pine needles and ferns and the shrubs with red fruits for the songbirds. Back at the van, Omi fries the mushrooms with onions and cream. She puts a small electric lantern on the folding table and we share a bottle of wine as water laps on the shore past the trees. Next day, the road turns from potholed tarmac to concrete and the van leaps over joints between the slabs. This is a Panzerstrasse, explains Omi, a road built for tanks. It leads us to the village where Omi was born, although the name has changed. Derelict aircraft hangars are reclaimed by the forest, overgrown with mosses and ferns. Quaint German houses decay beside concrete apartment blocks. One of the houses is Omi's old family home, but we can't know which. The van is drawing stares and sideways glances. A woman in a headscarf hangs washing on a line and children kick a ball around a fenced playing square. We don't even step out of the van. Omi makes a turn and we head back to the road. We part ways in the city of Kaliningrad. I have to get home and Omi will follow the coast north and catch a ferry back to Germany. She leaves me at the central station, anxiously checks I have my tickets and passport, berates a conductor and puts me on the train, glances over her shoulder as she walks along the platform and the engine ticks into gear. That evening, as I spoon beetroot soup in the dining car and the clouds grow red, I get a text. Omi has crossed the border and parked her van at the beach. She has found some field mushrooms, fried them with onions and cream, and she has been swimming in the sea.
Recently, some friends and I went on a short hike. Returning home ravenous some hours later, I invited them in for a quick cup of tea. "I have a fresh batch loaf if you want something to eat," I said. "Ah, no," said friend number one. "I have to get home. A cup of tea would be lovely, though." "I'm in a rush as well," said friend number two. "And besides, I never eat white bread." "Grand so," I said. "A cup of tea it is." The two of them sat down at the kitchen table while I put the kettle on. "I haven't seen bread like that in years," said friend number one, eyeing the batch loaf in its red and yellow packaging on the kitchen worktop. "It's for my brother who lives in England," I said. "It's what he always asks for when he comes home. That and lots of butter." "Sure, I might as well have a slice, seeing as how it's here," she said. I went and got some plates, knives and the butter dish. Friend number one took the batch loaf and began to peel open the greaseproof paper wrapping. She opened back the fold, prized up the heel and eased out a slice. She laid the slice on her plate, picked up her knife and took the lid off the butter dish. "Oh, yum," she said. "Real butter. Nothing like it." The scent of freshly baked batch loaf wafted around the table. "Have you any jam?" she asked as she dug her knife into the butter and began to spread a large yellow dollop onto her slice. Friend number two watched all this with interest. Her eyes were transfixed on the knife as it spread the butter right up to the edges of the crust in neat circular swirls. "I don't eat butter either," she announced, apropos of nothing. But her voice didn't hold the same assertion it had when she told us she never ate white bread. It may even have held a hint of regret. It really was only a matter of time. The butter spreading complete, friend number one cut the slice in two, unscrewed the lid from the blackberry jam and scooped out a large spoonful. This she spread on the curvy side of her batch slice, leaving the straight side jam free. She then cut each half slice in two, picked up one of them and bit into it. "Mmm," she said, her teeth leaving a deep semicircular curve in the butter. Friend number two shifted in her seat and sipped her tea. I, by now, was already buttering my own slice of batch loaf. As I bit into it, friend number one was reaching for a second helping. That was when friend number two cleared her throat. "Have you any marmalade?" she asked. "It's marmalade we had on it when I was a child." She picked up her knife, reached for a slice, and with a sigh of deep resignation, began to spread it with butter. A batch loaf may have a very distinctive scent, but as with Proust's Madeleine moment, it's the taste that brings the memories flooding back. The bread man arriving to our street in his horse-drawn van, the whinny of the horse, the clatter of the reins, the clip-clopping of the hooves, the mothers rushing out in their aprons, the wooden trays sliding out to display mouth-watering chocolate eclairs, cream doughnuts, Viennese whirls, and joy, the batch loaves, lined up like miniature pillows, their crust black-brown, their inside soft as thistledown. The bread man would pull the batch apart and place one loaf in my mother's outstretched hands. She'd carry it like a trophy back into the kitchen, to be sliced there and then without delay, each of us children smothering it with thick yellow butter and rushing back out onto the street to show off our bounty. The bread man's van would barely have reached the end of the street when all our batch loaf was gone. "Did bread and butter always taste this good?" my two friends wondered as we wiped the crumbs away. I assured them it did. Nothing now remained of the batch loaf, only the two heels, which nobody in our house ever wanted anyway, and usually found their way into the toaster when the day-old freshness had waned. Ah, well, sure, there was nothing for it, only to go out and buy another loaf. We couldn't let my brother down now, could we?
You sheltered me from harm, kept me warm, kept me warm. You gave my life to me, set me free. Set me free.
The 1985 Heysel Stadium disaster is a far-off, almost forgotten tragedy. But for those directly affected, it casts long shadows. Brussels in the 1980s was a bourgeois, cosmopolitan city, mesmerizing in its linguistic complexities, but relaxed, at ease with itself. The Irish community was small. We had a Gaelic club, which played occasional matches, and a soccer team in the Brussels Embassy League. Through this rather loose connection, 10 of us got tickets for that year's European Cup final at Heysel Stadium on the 29th of May. Unexpected, but very exciting. Liverpool were facing Juventus and our tickets were for the neutral terrace. The day itself was hot, steamy and sticky. Ahead of the game, fans gathered and drank strong Belgian beer in the many bars around the Grand Place. We went directly from work by metro from Schuman, the European Commission headquarters. Our suits left at the office, T-shirts and jeans more in keeping with our anticipation of a great game between Europe's leading clubs. Getting into the ground presented few difficulties. Local policemen surveyed the good-humoured crowd. Around us on the neutral terrace were many Belgian-born Italians, most of them sons of migrant workers who had come to work in the mines after the war. The first hints of trouble were fairly mild. Some Liverpool fans started chanting from their terrace, divided from us neutrals by only some flimsy barriers and a handful of policemen. But chanting is normal enough. Attention now turned to the match just 20 minutes from kickoff. Then some Liverpool fans started tossing things at us. Oranges, apples, tomatoes. The people around us became restless, like a herd sensing predators. What happened next was much more sinister. Harder missiles were coming our way. Some Liverpool supporters, thugs, not supporters in truth, were now hurling bottles at us and stones. They were swarming the little barriers. Now they were over them, brushing the hapless policemen aside and charging us, brandishing poles which moments earlier had carried proud Liverpool colours. We were in the midst of a panicking crowd, and quickly in the crush I was separated from my companions. Some of the crowd were running back up the terrace towards the exits, some pushing down towards the pitch. I decided going down wasn't good, and going up wasn't great either, so I tried to hold my ground. Those running back were wisest, I later discovered, for they escaped the imminent mayhem, but for the odd slap of a stick or loss of a shoe. Those pushing or being pushed downwards, squeezed into others further down who fell and were crushed against the crumbling wall protecting the pitch. Such was the pressure, there was little chance to climb the wall and reach the pitch. Even if your arms were free, the rest of you was trapped in the crowd. I tried to hold on, but the crowd eventually forced me down. I fell and those beside me did likewise until we were a human heap, like a landslide slowly rolling down the terrace. I managed to wriggle to a crowd barrier, which afforded some slight protection, and lay there trying to free my shoulders and breathe while being pinned down by falling and fallen bodies. I remember thinking, this is absurd. I've played hurling
all my life. I've been in every big stadium watching GAA and rugby. And now I'm going to die at a football match because of hooliganism. But in 6 or 7 minutes, perhaps, I began to feel the pressure on my back ease, and I could sense the crowd beginning to stand up behind me. The thugs seemed to be in retreat. I unsteadily began to stand up, but the two men who had been pressing down on my arms did not. They were motionless, either worn out by their efforts to stay alive or possibly already dead. Shaking, I looked around for help. I could see police reinforcements coming across the terrace. At the terrace walls, there were piles of people still unable to move, trapped just inches from the pitch and safety. Further up the terrace, bodies lay strewn where they fell. A Red Cross volunteer appeared beside me. Her colleagues would look after the injured, she told me. She helped me to the pitch and I walked unsteadily to the far end, trousers and shirt ripped, face, arms and hands scratched and bloodied to rest a while in safety. The pitch was slowly cleared of human casualties and incredibly, the match went ahead. This was afterwards explained as being to reduce the risk of more crowd trouble. I stood in a daze for a while, then managed to get out, onto a metro and back to Schumann to join my girlfriend and other friends and seek out news of those who had not yet returned from Heysel. It was a long night of waiting and wondering until 2 or 3 in the morning when we were able to confirm that all our friends were safe. I was also trying to phone home, fully aware that the tragedy had been shown live on television, unfolding as the TV audience waited for the match to begin. When I finally got through to my parents, it was 11:30, as the lines had been blocked for hours. I could hear the relief and uncharacteristic emotion in my father's voice when he said, "We're so delighted you're all right." Next day, we woke up to a shocking toll of death and destruction. Among the 39 dead, all from the neutral terrace, were 32 Italians, 4 French, 2 Belgians, and a man from Belfast. About 600 people had been injured and treated by the emergency services or in hospitals across Belgium. There was much debate as to responsibility. Certainly the stadium was run down and unsuitable by the standards of the time. The placing of Liverpool fans was thoughtless, not least given the growing reputation of a small cohort of English fans for causing trouble and their lack of distinction between neutrals and opposing fans. Security was far from perfect, and policing within the stadium was almost totally lacking. In fact, it seems preparations by all concerned were hopelessly inadequate, with the important exception of the medical services. But not one of these inadequacies justifies the appalling behaviour of the perpetrators who had love of violence as their motive and certainly not love of football. The wheels of justice turned slowly. Almost 5 years later, some thugs were convicted of manslaughter and received very short sentences for the part they played in the disaster. As far as I was concerned, the message that violent hooliganism is not subject to proportionate justice could not have been clearer. I've never forgotten that day. I still think about those young men on the terrace around me who never came home. Husbands, brothers, sons. Children unborn, dreams unfulfilled. All because of a tragedy that should never have happened.
Recently, I stopped into TK Maxx to buy clothes hangers and walked out with a chocolate rabbit. The woman at the register dropped it into my bag as a thank you for considering signing up for their rewards program. Since I'd been thinking about chucking personal productivity to one side and spending the rest of my day rewatching the movie Chocolat, I viewed the chocolate rabbit as something akin to divine blessing of this plan and returned home to settle in. It wasn't just that I wanted to hear Johnny Depp with his Irish accent, and the movie's assertion that chocolate can cure most ills just strikes me as obvious. It was more that, each time the north wind comes around, the film's main character uproots herself and moves someplace new. This is a compulsion I know something about. As a kid, I'd imagined a simple future whose trajectory would be defined by my dream of becoming a writer. I'd go to university, write books, marry, and live quietly in New England with three children and a basset hound I'd call Clyde. Life unfolded differently, however. Following graduation, I navigated difficult relationships, moving from state to state until I found myself lost and driving north one autumn through the desolate Texas plains, landing, ultimately, in a gold mining town tucked into the Colorado Rocky Mountains. I arrived with everything I owned stuffed into the back of my truck and no sense at all where my life was headed. The town resembled a Western movie set. At 8,300 feet in elevation, it had 200 residents, dirt roads lined with wooden cabins, a general store, and a two-room schoolhouse. It had dense pockets of aspen trees, 4-foot winter snowfalls, and coyotes who howled at night as if there were something in the heavens they needed and were trying to lasso with their sound. And it had John. John was 40 years older than me. He had white hair and a fondness for Stilton cheese. Originally from Manchester, he was a climate physicist who specialized in the study of lightning. He was also a poet. Hearing that I enjoyed writing, he suggested we meet to discuss our work. The problem was that I had none to share. For years, I'd spent equal amounts of energy both wanting to write and avoiding doing it. I'd been preoccupied with survival, afraid that to dabble in writing would only illuminate the painful distance of that dream. But I was too polite to refuse John's offer, so I said yes and spent the next several days fumbling with a poem. When the day came, I climbed the stone steps to John's cabin feeling like a fraud. We sat clutching mugs of tea in his bay window. I knew my poem was clumsy, but John never said so. Instead, he sought reasons for praise and gently suggested edits. He shared one of his own poems, telling me afterward, laughing, how an ex-girlfriend had criticized his reading voice. "I hate your yearning voice," she'd said when they'd broken up. But I listened closely to John, noticing how even the room itself seemed to lean in when he read. In the months afterward, we continued our workshops, and I kept on writing. Sometimes, to pass an evening, a group of townspeople would gather in John's cabin to share poems, stories, or music. Adopting a fake-it-till-you-make-it approach, I shared my work as well, my voice quavering. We'd sit in shadows cast by the wood stove's tangerine flames and tumble out later for the walk home, sweeping our torches around to look for bears. Here, I used to think, was a place I could remain forever. Here was simplicity and a warm, rare alignment with what it meant to be human in the natural world. But I sensed change on the gusting winds. I started attending summer workshops, and a few years ago, I moved to Dublin to study creative writing at Trinity College, which is how I came to be watching Chocolat the other day while peeling the foil off a chocolate rabbit. It had been years since I'd been in a university setting, but I'd loved the Trinity program and had made it through. I'd believed I would because of John, who developed dementia and passed away shortly before my move. And really, this isn't a story about writing, but rather about John and people like him. The ones who blow into your life and help you remember who and where you meant to be. How the immortal weather of their kindness persists. the way a mountain lion once crossed my path in a Colorado canyon, and I watched its noble head slip into darkness, while its tail in my headlights kept going on.
He was born in the summer of his 27th year, coming home to a place he'd never been before. He left yesterday behind him, you might say he was born again.
A dance in the gap of time. And soul, rise up and dance, the words you wrote a decade ago. Vietnam still vivid in mind and feet, a Mekong of water under all the bridges since, the mighty river of our lives sweeping all before it and rising, rising, the elver soup you ate in Saigon, the splendor of Ho Chi Minh City, though you didn't go to see the shrine. How to keep your feet steady, or kick fast and stay afloat, swim, dance to shore, away from shore, under the Pont du Diable, the sandstone arches hot in the summer glare. All that fall, that rise, that splash and gulp and kick, a black calf in a springing meadow. You're 13 again and hanging back, longing to take the floor, not sure how to put a foot forward best or not. And kind, blunt Keelty spots your need and grabs your hand, grabs to the hand of little Bridget McGovern from Glan and pushes you together out onto the prefab floor and you're away 10cc rubber bullets. I went to a party at the local county jail. Not too far away, real bullets flying. Years later, 81, you almost land in the local jail as you dance around a Gartha car outside Creevely Hall, asking them what they're doing, watching the crowds coming to a dance in support of the hunger strikers in the north. You're pinned against the car, all your drunken fervour up against the strong arm of the law, and you lose, but are not locked up, because the guard knows your sister. And in you go to waltz triumphant, maybe jive, you don't remember, talk for Ireland for sure. Sean South from Gary Owen were on the one road, the men behind the wire. And they should have been dancing, the young men, not martyred, emaciated, sainted, dead. They should have been free and wild on disco floors, in parish halls, in Mayflowers and ballrooms of romance and lust, and falling in and out of love. Shots volley out, clods fall. I saw a ghost in Creevely Hall, a loom at the window, impossibly tall. My brothers hear footsteps echo walk across the empty floor one winter day. Summers we'd walk through the ruins of the house in the hills where my parents started out in 44. Music and dance in that small stone kitchen on the September night they married. Mick Woods, 14, and a head of blackberry hair on him. The lintel over the door still in place, the back wall a gap of broken stone. We step out into the haggard and how the midges flicker and smudge. Near Pulna still, you catch a greenish frog and watch its quiet pulse. Then acrobat stretch and bounce away to water. Kyo Lee. The dancing mind brings back old words and phrases, blue mould cleared and language bubbles up, all there, tap, tap. And a field away, another house, gone, gone, horse skull under a flagstone, another flag scooped out round for milk. The black cat lands, a shadow in from shadows, licks and licks, purr sets music stirring. And a tune breaks out, up and away. He seizes the woman round the kitchen, over the cradle, out the door. The fields fly, ditches, briars. A baby tumbles into a gripe, and winged she rises up, clears white thorn, electric wires tall as Scots pine. Swallow, marten, wren, air, crane, swift air. Till cry, squall, legs flailing, iron around her, holy water. Cat by the hob, green-eyed, tail flicking, swish, swish. Later, or was it earlier, another dance, the moon behind the hill, soars out, goodbye forever, go, gone, footstick across water, never home. Marianne, Marianne, the bus conductor waltzes a small girl's doll.